Good morning, Boke Tov to everybody. Welcome. It's always wonderful to see everybody here. This is our last of a series of four. Next week, we will be going on to a new series of topics. I promised you some issues to do with kashrut, and there are lots of very fascinating modern contemporary halakhic and hashgafic conundrums when it comes to kashrut. I think we'll kick off next week with something that is a moving target, and you'll see more and more of it on the market, which is the kashrut status of Scotch whiskey, because this is something which is close to my heart. For those that there are more and more Scotch whiskies with hechsherim, even serious Scotch whiskies, and the question is whether that's necessary, desirable. Don't worry, if you don't want to come to the show because you'd rather not hear what I have to say, you won't be disappointed. It's fine, I don't want to give anything away, but we can have a l'chaim after the show as well. I'm not promising that. But we are not yet in the realm of the Scotch. We are today looking at the last of this series of four, which I think in many ways is the most fascinating, which is the question of human cloning. Human cloning is not science fiction. It is something which we are scientifically, theoretically at least, able to do. And we need to give a little bit of an introduction as to how the science works. I apologize in advance, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a biologist, and I'm certainly not an expert in cloning. But I think we need to understand the basics of it. Normally speaking, human reproduction works like this. A normal cell has 46 chromosomes in the human being. Males produce sperm which have 23 chromosomes, and women produce ova which have another 23 chromosomes, and when those two come together, then you have a fertilization, you end up with 46 chromosomes. Cloning does not work that way. Cloning works in the following way. In order to clone a mammal or an animal or even a human being, you basically need three volunteers. You need three different people. We'll see, they could be the same person, but there are three stages to it. First of all, you need a donor. The donor in this case is not a sperm or an egg which has 23, but the donor is a regular cell from the body which has 46 chromosomes, meaning they'll take a regular cell from the human body or from the animal body, from different parts. There are certain parts of the anatomy that lend themselves more to cloning than others, but they'll take that cell, and what they'll do is they'll persuade it to kind of activate itself, meaning what? A regular cell, a skin cell or a liver cell or a nerve cell, etc., there are certain parts of the genes which are turned on, which is what makes it into a gene, a nerve cell or a stomach cell or whatever, and there are certain parts of the genes that are turned off, and they're able to stimulate in different ways, which I'm not going into now, the cell, so that all the genes begin to turn on. What they will do then is they will take out the nucleus. I'm sure people are aware the cell has a nucleus in the middle which has almost all the genetic material. They'll take out the nucleus, and now they will put it somewhere else, and this is where our second volunteer comes in. You need an egg, you need an ovum, from a fertile female. But we're not really going to use that ovum, because what they do is they take that ovum, and they remove the nucleus from that ovum. It's an enucleated ovum. So now you just have a cell without a nucleus. And now what they have to do is persuade this nucleus that we have from the donor, and this empty, if you like, egg that we have from the ova, to merge together. And they are able to persuade them to do that in different ways. One way they do it is they can give them an electrical shock. I know it sounds a bit like Frankenstein, but they actually do administer an electric current, and they persuade the two cells to merge together. The nucleus then goes into the cell, and that cell now thinks that it is a fertilized egg. And that's the point. No sperm was ever involved here. But that cell now believes that it's a fertilized egg and will start to reproduce and multiply. And what they then now need is the third volunteer, which is someone to carry that egg in order to create the cloned animal. And therefore they will take a uterus of, if it's a cow or a sheep or a rat, we'll see, and they will put that now artificially, if you like, created egg, which was a nucleus and an empty egg, and they will grow it, and lo and behold, you end up with a cloned animal. And I brought you on page one a little diagram which I found useful. You can look at it now or later, which basically says what I just said. You see the three sheep, the adult sheep here. You have the donor nucleus taken from a cell of one sheep, and then an egg taken from another, fused together, turned into an embryo, and then placed into what they called here a foster mother, and then you end up with a little cloned lamb. Now, everybody, of course, remembers the famous sheep, which was Dolly the sheep. We have not been quiet since Dolly the sheep, although things did not go in the direction that people thought they would. Go over to page 2 for a second. It wasn't just Dolly that was cloned. Over the last 20, 30 years, we've been able to scientifically clone many, many animals. From early days with a frog and a fish there, to a mouse, to Dolly the sheep, which was 1996, already 21 years ago. A pig was cloned in 2000, a goat, a cat, a horse, a mule, an ibex, a rat, an arctic wolf, not exactly sure what you're going to do with an arctic wolf, different kinds of cattle, deer, dog, a monkey, which is very interesting, a rhesus monkey, a camel, and a coyote. All of these animals have been successfully cloned using basically this system that I just described. The human genome was mapped in the year 2000, and if anyone remembers, there were all sorts of announcements at the time. That's it, we've now discovered the cure for almost any disease, we just need to play with the genes. It hasn't quite turned out that way over the last 17 years, but we have been able to do an awful lot with that genetic technology. Most of that have not been cloning animals, meaning we can clone animals, and we do clone animals. And there are thousands and thousands and thousands of animals cloned every year. In fact, China is building more and more factories, planning to clone hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of animals for meat production. And therefore, they will be cloned animals coming onto the food production line. If there aren't already, there are soon. Yes. It depends on how you clone them, but yes. Yes, the animals will be able, depends on what you... Correct. It depends on where you take the cell from, and you can produce males or females, and then they can breed in their own way. One thing which we haven't yet done, at least officially, is produce a human clone. There may be people, in most countries it's illegal to actually work actively on human cloning technology, but as far as we're aware, they have not yet done that. However, what they have done is as follows, and I brought you on just before we get into the Machairus here. There are a number of general benefits and concerns and dangers to cloning. What are the benefits? Well, here's what we have been doing for the last 20 years with cloning, which is stem cell development. Even though they haven't been producing people, and they're not really that interested in producing animals, other than maybe for meat, etc., they have been producing a lot of stem cells. How does that work? You go through the process that I just described, and you take the nucleus, and you take the egg, and you fuse them together. But instead of growing a fetus, you keep it as an embryo, and now it's producing all these stem cells. Stem cells are very early stage cells that embryos produce, and they're extremely versatile. They can bifurcate into almost any kind of body cell that you want, and they have been using those to create organs, to cure different diseases. They can create insulin, renew cell activities. They've been working on Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. A failing organ can be injected with different kinds of stem cells. I'm oversimplifying. It's obviously not that simple. But they have found ways to turn on and off the genetic makeup of these cells in order to produce the exact target type of cell that they're doing. This they've been doing very successfully. And whereas maybe we thought 20 years ago there'd be cloned people running around by now, that's certainly not the case, but there's an awful lot of cloning technology in medicine. The other thing that they're, and that's totally legal in most places, the other thing that they're doing is producing chimeras. Chimeras are actually, they sound a bit weird, but they've been also proved to be very useful, which is where you actually fuse nuclei from different animals together. You'll take a nucleus from a human cell and you'll put it not into a human egg, but into a mouse egg, or into a cow egg, or something like that. And although that sounds a bit strange, and we'll talk about it halakhically and haskafically, that they've been doing as well, and they've had all sorts of success with that in curing different kinds of cancers. Also, organ replacement. Cloning technology has been used to genetically engineer animal organs. This week, every week there seems to be something else. This week, since the last year, in the New York Times, and I'm not a reader of the New York Times, but it seems to come up recently, the New York Times reported that they've been able to genetically change a pig organ. Pig organs are very useful for organ transplants because they're roughly the same size. There's no point taking an elephant heart or a mouse heart. It's not going to do much good either way, but a pig heart is perfect. However, the pigs carry various different viruses that they found are able to cross over into human beings, and therefore they've not been successful in different ways. And what they have now done is they've been able to snip out the virus parts of the pig and clone the pig organs, and that's something that is coming online for organ transplant for people. And obviously that's not even a shaila halachically. To have a pig organ is not a question at all, because it's pikuach nefesh, it's not even achila in any way, there's no problem with it being a pig whatsoever. They've also been able to correct genetic diseases, livestock production, infertility. Infertility, they thought this was going to be a big issue, and maybe it will be in the future, but let's say one or both of the couple were infertile. He wasn't producing viable sperm, or she wasn't producing viable eggs. Well, they could clone a baby from one of them, from the father or from the mother, take one of those cells, and put it into an egg, either her egg or a donor egg, but it's not a donor egg with much genetic material, and we'll see that in a minute, and then she could carry the egg, and it's 99.5% their genetic material. We'll see there's a little bit in the egg that they can't get rid of, the mitochondria. That's another option. And we'll go into questions soon as to who would be the father, who would be the mother. We'll talk about that in halacha in a minute. There is also a possibility. There are people, for example, who have mitochondrial problems. What is a mitochondria? So as well as the nucleus, there are very tiny, microscopic, obviously, inside the cell, little power packs, which produce energy for the body. Not enemy. Energy for the body. These are called mitochondria, and they have their own DNA. They have their own DNA, irrespective and independent of the nucleus. So there are people that have a mitochondrial genetic problem, which means there's nothing wrong with 99% of their DNA in the nucleus, but there's a problem with the mitochondria. So what is a woman going to do if she has a mitochondrial problem that will cause diseases in her child? So what she can do is she can take her nucleus, a donor egg without a nucleus, but still with its mitochondria, okay, and then they can do a cloning procedure and she can carry that egg. And that way, they put healthy mitochondria, if you like, into the baby by using a donor egg. And it's not a donor egg, except insofar as 1% of the genetic material, but 99% is still hers. It's not like a regular egg donor situation where you're taking a completely different egg from a completely different woman. So that they found they can do as well. And various other things that I've listed. Older women, for example, that want to have babies in their 40s, and they find that their eggs aren't healthy enough, if you like, to have those babies. What they can again do is take a donor egg, and they can put her nucleus into the donor egg, and then they can fertilize with the husband's sperm and maybe even produce the baby. So there's all sorts of things they can do. But then it begins to get into the borderline areas. What about reproducing a child or a family member that died by using their genetic material? Is that legitimate or is that illegitimate? Is that a benefit or is that not? If a couple, lo aleinu, lost a child, but were able to save some genetic material, is it appropriate that they should reproduce, reclone that child, and have that child over again? Or is that just fundamentally something that we would find difficult psychologically, emotionally, etc., etc.?
That hasn't done yet?
No, they haven't done that yet, but they could, in theoretically, do that. They could even remove genetic material after a person has died. Not just before. What about restoring extinct species? And again, this is science fiction, Jurassic Park, and all that. But it's still, in theory, something they could do. It's really fictional because they need adult cells to do this. These are all benefits, potentially, that we could have. But there are dangers. For example, cloning technology is still very new. In order to produce the clones, there's a lot of mistakes along the way. Dolly the sheep was only produced after 276 failed cloning attempt, which means that it produces embryos which are awfully deformed and unviable, or even if they're born, they can be born with multiple limbs, with different defects. Is that something that we can even countenance when it comes to human cloning, producing clones which may be horribly deformed before we get it right? Also, with meat on the market, are we worried that cloned meat might have something in it that down the road we will discover is dangerous in different ways? And I brought some other concerns as well. What if people were cloning people for use as human experimentation models? or to clone people as slaves. Is that going to happen? Is that not going to happen? People talk about this, etc. What about, and then we'll go on to the halakhic issues, what about cloning someone in order to use them as an organ donor for you? And there have been various novels written about this kind of issue. For example, let's say somebody needs bone marrow. Could they clone themselves and produce a clone who effectively was a bone marrow donor to save the original person's life? Is that legitimate or is that illegitimate? Now, on the one hand, you think, well, how can you bring someone in the world just to be a donor? On the other hand, the net result of that is you have two people who are alive. One person who has now been saved, one person who would never have been born but has now been born and is giving bone marrow, as opposed to one person who's died and another person who would never have been born. Which is a better scenario? It's not so straightforward. However, luckily we have some good sources that will help us out with some of these questions. Go over to page 3 and let's get into the meat of the question. Now, not meat is perhaps the, not clones meat. Last week, for those who weren't here, and I'm going to recap briefly, we talked a lot about hashgafic issues. And let me just recap for you. We said that there's a Tiferet Yisrael that says that the presumed position, halachically, is unless the Torah says that it's prohibited, we assume that it's permitted. Because the Torah didn't come to tell us all those things which are allowed. It only came to tell us those things which we should not do, or extra things we should do. But generally, if it's silent, we assume that's okay. And therefore, halachically, I must tell you, it's very hard to find anything explicit that would have an issue with cloning. Very difficult. And therefore, the usual position of most poskim when they approach this question is that probably halakhically, technically, it's difficult to say that there's anything wrong with it. However, you go beyond the pure halakhic. You had a question?
Wasn't Chava
cloned? No, she wasn't cloned. Okay, we'll get to Chava in a minute. Chava was created by God in a different way, maybe it's not quite the same as cloning. Beyond the pure halachic, though, there are other issues, and we looked at those last week. There are hashgafic, or the Ruach HaTorah issues. We looked at Kilayim, and the fact that the Ramban and others in the Sefer Achinot say the mitzvah of Kilayim is there to sensitize us to certain boundaries, and there are boundaries which we must not cross, even within the natural world. There is a mitzvah of kishuv, or a prohibition of kishuv, of trying to create or do things which are beyond the natural world in some way. And we said that in theory you could talk about those boundaries with these issues, but in practice it's difficult to say that what we're doing here is really kilayim. It's all working within a natural system in order for a therapeutic purpose. And also it's not really kishuv either. So it's difficult to pin down any clear hashgafic issue, other than to recognize that there are boundaries which we have to be aware of. Also, it's not just a binary thing. It's not just mutter or osa. There are at least 5 levels when you're analyzing anything and asking, is this okay, halachically? It's not just yes or no. There are at least 5 levels, from prohibited, on the one hand, that they say they're one extreme, then permitted, but b'dieved, i.e. undesirable, but okay in certain circumstances, to permitted and neutral, it's fine, you can do it or not do it, it's up to you, to permitted and desirable, a mitzvah, we call it a mitzvah kiyumit, meaning it's a mitzvah, but you don't have to, but if you do, it's a wonderful thing, to chiyum, which is, it's an obligation, you must do it. So it's important for us to not just think about whether it's okay or not okay, where on that spectrum of 5, if you like, levels, from prohibited to obligatory, where would it go? And that's a question we'd have to think of ourselves and think as well. What are the potential halachic benefits? Well, there are some halachic benefits. First of all, some fertility treatments, most in many ways, require problematic halachic interventions. For example, artificial insemination of different types requires the sperm to be harvested. That is not a straightforward halachic issue. Having donors from complete third parties. We saw last week, we talked about Rav Moshe Feinstein, who gave the sack, which permitted artificial insemination by donor, even though most of the poskim of the world were radically opposed to it, it was very controversial. This would avoid the need to do that. You don't need a donor. You can have a cloning system from within the couple themselves, or the person themselves. So there are potentially benefits to do that. And also, someone last week raised the question of mamzerus. If you take sperm from a man who is not the husband of the woman who's having the treatment, and you introduce that either into the woman or in the lab, in IVF, is there a question of mamzerus? So there's a debate. Some people thought there was, some people thought there wasn't. Cloning, presumably, there's no problem with it. There's no sperm involved. And then we'll have to get into these other questions in a minute. On the other hand, there are concerns, and I've set them out here, and we've talked about some of them already. Now, let's bring some sources into this. How many parents is a child meant to have? So, the Gemara talks about this. Number two, Tana Rabbana. Shloisha Shutzim Yesh Ba'adam. There are three partners that go into creating a person. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Aviv, the Imon. God, the father, and the mother. Aviv, Mazriah, Halboven. Now, without getting into all the science exactly as to how this works and whether this is, we understand this to be accurate, the father basically says the Gemara gives a certain amount of material, genetically we call it today, the white material. Shemimenu, Atzamot, the bones are formed, the gidim and the sinews, the tziporanim and the nails, the moach and the brain tissue, Sheberosh, the loivin Sheberayin and the whites of the eyes. Imai, the mother, what does she contribute genetically? Mazrat, Oden, she gives the red stuff. And again, I'm not interested in the science of this right now. Shemimenu, or she gives the skin, the basar and the meat, the sarot and the hair, the shachor Sheberayin and the black of the eye. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu, now you say, what does God give? Ruach, the neshama, they give the spirit and the life force, who cluster panim and the ability to understand and see, v'riyat ha'ayim, and to see through the eyes, shmir ta'oizen, v'dibuper, and the power of speech, remember that, we'll come back to it in a minute, v'haloch raglaim, and the ability to walk, ubina, and understanding, v'seichel. Seichel comes at the end, and some people didn't quite get that last one, seichel, but in theory, you're meant to have seichel as well. Therefore, you need three partners in order to make a human being. And a source that I didn't give you, which is worth mentioning, is a Midrash Rabbah in Breishis, where it says the following, L'sha'ava Adam, Nivra, in the past, man was created from the Adama, from the dirt, and Chava, now it's your pun on Chava, Nivra min ha'Adam, she was created out from the person, and says the Midrash, Mikan ve'elech, from this point on, v'tzalmenu k'meduseinu, people will reproduce in the normal way. Lo ish below isha, velo isha below ish. A man shouldn't do it without a woman, and a woman shouldn't produce without a man, velo shnehim below shechina, and neither should try and do it without the shechina. Now, what is the status of that measure? Is it saying that you have to have a father, and you have to have a mother, in order to create a child, or is it saying, that's the most desirable way to do it, but b'di'evet, and this back to our point of b'di'evet, maybe there are other ways that you can do it. For example, we see, and we always have seen, there are many children who throughout history have grown up without a father and a mother, either because of divorce or because of bereavement. And many of these people grow up, most of these people grow up into fully functional and contributing members of society in loving homes, into happy and balanced people. But should we be creating those scenarios, the chatchila, or is it only b'di'evet that we want that, or that we're accepting of that? Let me give you two difficult scenarios which are not directly cloning, but are very contemporary, at least the first one is. Is it appropriate for a single woman who is maybe approaching the menopause to decide, look, I've tried to get married, I'm not going to get married now, let's be realistic, I want to have a child, I'm going to have an artificial insemination by a donor, and I'm going to bear a child that way without a husband. Is that, and this is something that people do a lot. And it's increasingly being done because increasingly we're seeing this pressure and tension on marriage and people not being able to find marriage partners and eventually realizing that they're never going to find one. Is that okay or is that not okay? What does okay mean? So many poskim, and I brought you a list here, were very negative about this. Rav Shlomo Zalman was very against this. Rav Eliashiv was very against this. Rav Waldenberg, Kitz Eliezer was very against this because they said that's not the way to create a Jewish family. You don't create a Jewish family, lechatchila, with just a mother and no father. On the other hand, we're not in a lechatchila situation. We're dealing with a b'di'evet, after-the-fact situation, where there are many women who are not able to find marriage partners. So, in that situation, could you invoke the, if you like, b'di'evet in that way? And the same was going to be, the same question is going to be of cloning. If you're going to be inventing or creating families in very unconventional ways, we'll see soon a woman can create the entire thing from her own body. She can give the nucleus and she can give the cell and she can carry the baby and She is all three partners, if you like, in it. Is that legitimate? Is that not legitimate? L'chad chile b'dievet, etc. Also consider the following quite famous tragic case. There was a case in Israel a few years ago, Captain Omri Shachar, who died in the army in a car crash, and his parents wanted to have sperm taken from his body after he died so they could produce a grandchild from him that they would raise as their own child. Now, his girlfriend said, I'm not interested in carrying that child. I don't think he was married. Was he married? I'm not sure. We could check that. But anyway, his partner did not want to carry the child. But the grandparents said, fine, we'll find someone else that will bear the child. The main thing is, we want to have a grandchild from the child that they never lost. And the Israeli state opposed that. And there's been a court case going since. First of all, they won their case in the family court. I think it was in Petah Tikva, they won their case there. But then it was appealed again, etc. Is this legitimate? The state turned around and said, the Israeli government, this was not legitimate because this was called planned orphanhood. You are bringing in a child into the world who from the very beginning will have no father, and it said that the child will be fragile in relation to children from normative families. Is that true anymore? Is there any such thing anymore as a normative family? You know, I had a student, I'm not going into details, I had a student even years ago now in a seminary I taught that they told us at the beginning of the year, there's a student here who has four mothers and no fathers. I'm not going into how exactly that works, but you ask people, like, people's different family arrangements, it's very difficult to define what's normal, but these are difficult cases which have come up as to how many parents should there be with a child and how that works with cloning. Also, look at the bottom of the page here in 3, who owns your genetic material? Meaning, if someone were to assault you, God forbid, and remove against your will your genetic material, and then clone you without you accepting that, then I think everyone would agree that was halakhically prohibited. But what if someone were to take genetic material that you threw away? A blood sample that you're not interested in anymore? Or anything that you could take genetic material from? That's presumably hefker. Someone spits on the side of the road. They don't own that. And then someone comes along and takes the genetic material and say, oh, let's clone that and produce another one of him. Do you somehow have a copyright to your own genetic coding? Should you? Do we need to develop that? And who owns the genetic material of people who have died? Is it owned by their family? Is it owned by the people who inherit from them? These are all questions which we are still trying to work out how to answer and haven't got clear halakhi guidelines on. Let's talk about a few issues, and then we'll get into what I think are the most fascinating questions about the status of the clone itself. Is cloning something which is somehow against our concept of individuality? Does Judaism believe in individuality, or are we all meant to be clones of each other? Okay? I think it's very clear, no matter sometimes what it feels like, depending on where you are, that we're definitely meant to be individuals. It's absolutely fundamental to our Tzelem Elohim, that we are unique. Have a look here in source number 3, which is not strictly on the issue of the medical issue, but I love the source, it's fascinating. It's a source from the Yamshel Shlomo of Shlomo Luria, talking about Matan Torah. He says, Hamakubalim Tafru Tam Ladava. The Kabbalists have explained in the following way. Lefi Shekal HaNeshamas Hayu B'Har Sinai. Every Neshama was at Har Sinai. The Kiblu Derech Memtet Sinorot. And they received through 49 different channels. A sinora is a pipe, let's say, for channel. It was like a big Wi-Fi download. Everybody's tuned in at Har Sinai. The Hein HaKolot, and these are the sounds. Asher Shamu V'Gamro. You know what it says in the Pesukim, that they were able to see the sounds. He says, that's because they weren't sounds. He said this 400 years ago. This was information download being sent to the people standing at Har Sinai. That's what it means that they saw it. It means they could pick it up and internalize it. The Kol Yisrael Roim Et HaKolot. Heim HaDeil. Every Jewish person saw the noise, the voices, meaning, the sounds, meaning their knowledge. HaMitchal Kot B'Tinor. Each through his own pipe. Kol Echad Ra Derech Tinor Shelo. Each one had their own individual channel at Sinai. Lefi hasagot, according to their ability, the kibel lefi koach nishmot, and according to the power of their neshama, ha'elyoa leroy b'yoa, the higher ones according to the high level, or lepechituta zeh rechoch mizeh, or according to a lower level, one from the other. Add until She'echad yagir le'tahor. One could stand at HaSinai and say, what did God say? He said it was tahor. He said it was pure. The Hasheni yagir le'katzeh achron le'tameh. And a second person could be standing at HaSinai and hear exactly the same information and come to exactly the opposite conclusion and say, God said tameh. The Hashlishi and a third person, Lemtzot, could be in the middle. Now you know why Jews have multiple opinions. Rachot min ha-katzot, ha-kol va-ha-kol emet. They're all true. Meaning that the essence of our individuality is rooted in the fact that we stood at Sinai and all heard something very, very different. And in fact, there's a brocha that we see, that we say when you see 600,000 Jews. What brocha do you say when you see 600,000 Jews standing together? It's worth remembering this in case you ever walk around the corner, see 600,000 Jews standing together. So the Gemara in Brocha says, Tana Rabbanan, Haraye Uchlusia Yisrael. If you see 600,000 Jews, Omer, you say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam, Chacham Harazim. The knower of all secrets. That you're praising God, that God knows all secrets. What's that got to do with 600,000 people? So the Gemara explains, number four at the end. She'ein Da'atam Domeh Zerazeh. Because not one of these people has the same view as any other of these people. They all have different minds. Just like they all have different faces. Every person in the world has a different face. That is their face, that is their individuality, and they have their own opinion. And just like when you walk into my shir, I don't ask you to please get rid of your face and take my face, sit with my face. I similarly don't ask you to accept my opinion. You have your own opinion, your own understanding. And we make a brocha on this, which is that we praise this individuality. So maybe cloning in some way, there's something antithetical about producing hundreds or thousands or millions of people who are all apparently exactly the same in that way. I once thought that I was going to make this brocha so far. I went to the levaya of Rav Avadi Yosef. I'm sure other people were there as well. And I thought, wow, there's bound to be 600,000. In fact, there were over 750,000 people there. And I thought, this is it. I'm going to make the brocha. And in fact, I only saw in the whole levaya two people. The person who was squashed in my face there, and the person who was squashed in my face there. And I just walked through the whole levaya like that. I didn't see anything. My son, who had more seichel, he got the seichel bit at the end of the thought there. My son went to the top of the building and looked down there in Sanhedrin, and he was able to make the bracha. Okay, so that's his faith on Baruch Hashem. Chazal were very worried. What would be if everybody looked the same? Look at number five, a source in Sanhedrin. Mipnei ma'ein dom. Why don't people have the same faith? I mean, cats, a lot of them seem to look the same to me. Birds, goldfish. I've had a lot of goldfish in my time. And no, people all look different. People all look different. Why do they not have the same? So lo yira adam dira na, so a person wouldn't be an imposter, see a nice dira, see a nice apartment, the ishana, or a beautiful woman, and she'd say, Shelly, it's my wife, that's my wife. Look, I am a husband, don't I look like a husband? Chazal was very worried if everyone had the same face, people would do that. Tanya Haya Rabbi Meir, Oimer Rabbi Meir said, v'shloshidvarim adam ishtana mechaveya. There are three ways that people are all different from each other. Bakal, their voice, v'mare, in their appearance, Ubadat and in their view. The color of Mary, their voice and their appearance is different. Mishum Erva, like we said, so that people won't pretend to be the husband or the wife and cause a situation there. Ubadat, and why does everyone have a different view? Interesting point here, it says, Mitnea Gazlanim, Vahacham Sanim, because of thieves. Why? Because if I knew exactly how you thought, I would guess all your passwords for your computer. And I'd get into your bank account. That's what the reporters say. So they don't talk about the passwords, but they say that I would know exactly where you hide things and how you do things, and I'd be able to get into your mind. Everybody has to have a different face. Everybody has to have a different mind. And genetics, if you like, is not meant to make everybody the same. Now, the truth is, identical twins, good. So identical twins, first of all, are rare. And second of all, they're not actually quite identical. And that goes to the point which is clones as well. Clones also would not be identical, because let's not forget, if you clone the person, they don't just come out as the 45-year-old. You take a cell from a 45-year-old. You don't just produce a 45-year-old. You produce a baby who will then have all the different experiences and the different life influences that make them into a different person. So they might look the same when they get to 45, or they might not. They might have an accident in the playground when they're a kid, which makes them look different. They might have a scar, etc. So clones won't actually necessarily all be exactly the same, and they won't think the same. Why should they think the same? identical twins could be separated at birth, and they might look the same, but they have very different views. By the way, even clones have different fingerprints. Because fingerprints, I didn't know how fingerprints were made, but fingerprints are made apparently when the baby is falling in the womb, the different pressures of the water, the fluid within the womb as the finger is developing, pushes the finger in different directions, and that is completely unrepeatable. It's random, if you like, how that happens, and therefore fingerprints will always be different, even if you produce a million identical clones. So maybe cloning is a little bit antithetical to our understanding of individuality, maybe even a lot, and therefore that's something to think about. But let's get into some halakhic issues. Let's say we clone somebody. We clone the person and they're walking around the street. Is that a human being? What are they? What is the status of a clone? Does that have to be a biological father and mother? There isn't any sperm when it comes to a cloning situation. Everything could be taken from one person. How does that work? Do they count for a minion? People will be calling up a rabbi in a few years' time, maybe saying we've got eight guys and two clones. Can we count eight guys and two clones for a minion? We want someone who wants to say Kaddish. The clone wants to say Kaddish. You know, how does that work? So, what are the precedents for that? Who would he say Kaddish for? A son or a daughter or a wife? Or a sibling, if a clone has a sibling, we'll talk about that in a minute, or even a parent, if a clone has a parent. We'll see right now. The Gemara discusses the issue of a goylem. What is a goylem? Or, I'm from a Lithuanian, a Yiddish-speaking background, my parents always used to call it a galem, rather than a goylem. They used to say, don't sit there like a galem. And I didn't know what that meant for many, many years, except that it was something that I shouldn't do, okay? And the Gemara referred in a number of places to this. Now look at number 7. Rava bara gavra. Rava created a man, Rashi says. I've interposed Rashi in the source. Alidei Sefer Yitzira. He used Sefer Yitzira, which is a mystical work. Shalamdu Tziruf Otiyot Shel Shem. They combined the names of God in different ways and produced a goyim. They produced a man. Shadra Kamei de Rebbe Zeira. He sent him to Rebbe Zeira. Go to Rebbe Zeira. Havakam Mishnoi Behadei. And Rebbe Zeira was talking to the goyim. The Loi Havakam Mahadalei. But the goyim didn't say anything back. Why not? Rashi says, Shaloi Hayabod Dibur. Because the goyim, by definition, cannot speak. Goyim don't have the power of speech. Because remember, we said the power of speech, who gives what? The father, the mother, and God. The power of speech is from Hashem, and goyim is not created in that way. So that's why they call people a golem. They sit there like a golem, meaning they're sitting there still and saying nothing. A golem, so he didn't speak. So Rabbi Zeira then realized, oh, you know, I'm giving all this Divrei Torah, and the guy's a complete golem. And he says to him, Amalei, oh, min chavreyat. You're obviously someone who was created by one of my colleagues. Hadala apres, go back to the dust. And the golem fell down there. He got rid of the golem. He doesn't want someone there who's a golem talking to him about Divrei Torah, not talking to him. So he destroyed him. Okay, so a golem is clearly not human, otherwise Rabbi Zeira would have been guilty of murder. If you look for a second in number 8, the Maharshal says, "Allah had become a hadalei." He didn't respond to him. Because mankind alone cannot create the power of speech. If he share aim by an neshama, this person didn't have an neshama, this golem. Shua ruach ha'ole lemala. This is the ruach which goes up to shamayim after death. Rak ruach ha'chiyuni. He just had a life force like an animal. Shahaya gam came be behema. Are you ready to mata? He's a behema. A golem is basically a behema. Amalei, he said to him, had a lafresh. Go down into the dust. And therefore, in the case of a golem, it's very clear that a golem is not a human being. Does a golem count to a minion? Do you have to be a human being to count to a minion? So look at this fascinating source in number 9. Go over the page to number 9. The Chacham Tzvi, Rabbi Yaakov Emden's father, the Tzvi Ashkenazi, the Chacham Tzvi, in the 17th century, he has an interesting shaila here, number 9. Fakti, I have a question. Adam Anose Ali Dei Sefer Yetzirah, if you're able to create a person through Kabbalistic means, Ka'ayta Shamar of Sanhedrin, as a case of Sanhedrin, Rava Bara Gavra, then Rava created a person. V'chein he'idu al zikne hagon, Moreno harav Eliyahu, are based in the Chelm, and he also says his grandfather Eliyahu, this is not the Vilna Gaon, this is before, was able to create a golem as well. Fascinatingly, he doesn't mention the Maharal creating a golem. It's very dubious as to whether the Maharal created a golem. There's all sorts of other people who it says did create a golem, but there's not so much evidence for the Maharal's golem. There's a little bit, but that's not for now. Mima tzareik la'asara dvarim. Do le'dvarim ha'tzrikim asara. Do they count for a minion for things that require a minion? Could go in Kaddish, Kedusha. Mi amrina, do we say, kevin the ksiv, since it says in his Kaddashki, the top B'nai Israel, that you have to be sanctified within the Jewish people, it has to be B'nai Israel. Loim Yisrael, that he can't join because he's not a human being, he's not a Jew in that sense. Or Dilma, kevin the kaimalam Sanhedrin, hamagadol yasam b'tot beta. Or maybe, if because it says if you bring up an orphan in your house, ki'ilu yaldo, it's as if you gave birth to them, then even a goylem can become ki'ilu, your child. What is the answer to this? So Nirali, and you'll see his definition of human in a minute. Nirali, the kevin da ashkechen Rebbe Zera da ama min chavrai. Since we see that Rebbe Zera said you're not normal, tuvla afreis, go back to the dust. Harishahagru, we can see that he killed him. The isak adak jiyesh bo ta'elet letarfo la'asara, the chol dava shebekedusha. Loi hai Rebbe Zera ma'avilu min ha'ilam. This is a very funny thing. If this guy, obviously he wasn't human, Rebbe Zera killed him, he was fine. If this guy could have counted towards a minion, why would Rabbi Zera have killed him? It's so useful to have a minion man, says the Chacham Tzvi. It would have been a very useful fellow to have in the world. If he counted towards a minion, Rabbi Zera would have kept him and said, sit there until we need a minion. The fact that Rabbi Zera got rid of him, he said, obviously the guy was useless, and he said he didn't count to a minion, and he does, certainly is not human. And he said, and as for the murder, and this is the key bit I'm interested in, the Avshe Engbo Issa Shvichas Damim, there is no Issa of murdering this golem. The Hachi Dai Krakos, what is the posik of murder? Shofech dam ha'adam da'adam da'moyshek. If you spill the blood of a person that came from a person, then you're a murderer. Daska adam ha'noyshek etoich adam. In order to be human, you have to have come from another person. Dahaino ubar ha'notzeh b'me'e imo. You have to be an embryo, a fetus that came out of a woman's womb in order to be human. If you're not, then you're not human. And therefore the golem is not human, he wasn't created in this way, and therefore he was out to kill him. Well, is a clone someone that comes out of a womb of a female? And the answer is, at the moment, yes, absolutely. Because we are able to grow clones in a lab to the point that they be born. And therefore, almost all the poskim, look in number 11 for a second at Rav Steinberg, who is one of the key thinkers on these issues, he says number 11, does the clone product fall under the halachic category of a golem? Meaning, is a clone the same as a golem? Which does not have the full status of a human being, such as that he cannot be counted for a minion, may even be killed without a killer being guilty of murder. The answer is definitely negative, meaning the clone is not a golem. Since we learn that the prohibition of murder applies specifically to a person who is created within another person, i.e. someone who existed as an embryo within a mother's womb. This is not the case with a golem, who is brought to life by mystical means. In the case of cloning, we are dealing with the product of purely natural substances, and the child who is born is in fact first a fetus in its mother's womb. Therefore, the product of cloning clearly has the same status as any other flesh and blood person. And that is uniformly agreed on, that a clone is definitely human, and they do count for a minion, and therefore that is not even a shaila. The exact borderline between human and not human is not always totally clear. For example, let's say you had a human that was born from a cow. Could this be? Absolutely this could be. What they could do is they could take a human, nucleus and fuse it with a cow ovum and then grow that inside a cow so that it was born from a cow. Would that also be human? It would look like a human completely in all respects, but it's come out from a cow. Is that the same thing or is that not the same thing? This is, again, it's not science fiction. This is something that is possible. Look in the Talmud Yerushalmi number 10. Fascinating Talmud Yerushalmi. Rabbi Yassi says, B'shem Rabbi Yochanan, in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, number 10, Kula Adam, what if a person is all human? Upanav behema, but their face looks like an animal. Ein uvlad, then they're not human, they're an animal, because we go by the face. Kula behema. What say they say they look completely like an animal? Upanav Adam, but their face is a human face. Vlagu, then that's a human being. And obviously there are lots of implications to know whether someone's a person or an animal for 1,000 halachic reasons. Okay? So, good, we go by the face, we don't go by the body. But then the Gemara says, wait, one second. Kula Adam, upanav behema. if a person looks like a person, but they have the face of an animal. Only the Torah, but they're standing there and reading from the Torah. And you just said this person's an animal because their face looks like an animal. But Omer lo abayla shechafcha? You're going to tell them, come and be shechted? Of course it's a person. He's reading Torah. He's learning Torah. It can't be an animal if he's learning Torah. Kula behema, if you think the person is a person because he's an animal, upanav adam, but their face is a person, omer v'chorish v'sadeh, and they're plowing in the field like an ox. Omerim lo, you're going to say to him, boy v'chaloitso yiyavein? Are you going to say, come and do yibum with your wife? He's an animal. Meaning the Gemara here is trying to define what if a person seems to be a little bit of both. And it seems at the beginning to be saying we go by the face, but by the end it's saying no, we go by the context. Even if this person has an animal face but they're sitting and learning Torah, then they're obviously a person, not an animal. And if this person has a person's face and they're plowing in the field, then they're obviously an animal, not a person. You can see already that the Gemara was giving attention to the exact boundaries between what is a person and what is an animal. There's also a reference in the Mishnah in Kilayim to this orangutan-type creature, the Adnat HaSeva, and it's not clear exactly what that is. It looks like a person, but it's not a person. Again, the Mephoshim say it's an orangutan of some kind, and it seems to debate, well, where is the line between a human being and an animal? This is something that the sources have discussed at length, and we can see, in our case, generally it will be clear, but these cases like with the cow and the gestation inside the cow, it won't be as clear. Does a clone enable its cloner to fulfill the mitzvah pur avuz? You want to fulfill the mitzvah pur avuz, so you produce a few clones. Does that count? So here again we have the same questions. What is needed in order to fulfill pur avuz? Do you need a mother and a father? Do you need a physical relationship? Do you need a child? What about IVF? Does that fulfill pur avuz? Well, you do have the husband's sperm and the wife's egg, but they're fertilized in a non-natural, in a lab conditions. Does that fulfill pur avuz? And here, in this case, if there's no sperm at all, in what way can it be fulfilling pur avuz for the father if the father didn't produce, could contribute anything? It could be that the father had no contribution at all. This is clearly one of the questions that comes up as well. But most interesting, I think, of all, if you look at page 6, and we'll deal with this in one other topic, is who are the parents of the clone? Who are the parents of the clone? And I've given you 6 scenarios. Let's look at these scenarios. Now, who the parents and who the children are critical for a number of reasons. First of all, we need to know, is the child Jewish? That goes by, of course, the mother. We need to know who the child is allowed to marry. It can't marry people it's related to. So, of course, you need to know who it's related to. We need to know whether the child is a Kohen or a Levi or a Yisrael. That, of course, goes by the father. We need to know about Kibud Avaim. We need to know for Yibum. We need to know for inheritance. We need to know who is related to whom. Now, remember, who are the people that make a clone? 3 people. The one who gives the nucleus, the one who gives the egg, and the one who carries the baby. Okay? Let's give you a few different scenarios. Let's say the same woman does all 3. She gives the nucleus, she gives the egg, and it's fused, and she carries the baby. Well, who is the mother? She is. That's very clear. Who is the father? Oh, so some people want to suggest the grandfather, meaning the father is normally the one that contributes 50% of the genetic material. So who is the man in this scenario who was given 50% of that genetic material? It's actually the grandfather. Because she was half of her mother and half of her father, and all of this baby is from her, so half of it, so is the grandfather also the father? Or is the mother the father? Meaning, can a mother be a mother and a father at the same time? Or is a mother only able to be a mother? Or maybe there is no halachic father, which is probably the correct answer, because there are many people with no halachic father. Look at number 12. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Gershon is Gai, Kekodishin Ola Dami. A girl who converts to Judaism is like a brand new newborn child. It has no halachic parents. Of course, it still has a relationship with its biological parents. It can still be close to them and go to them for Thanksgiving, etc., etc. But halachically, technically speaking, it doesn't really have a mother and a father for different purposes. I think I mentioned this story before. I won't say it now. I haven't got time. I'll mention it maybe at the end of our time. What about the case of a shtuki? What's a shtuki? A shetuki is somebody, the Gemara discusses, the Mishnah discusses, is a child who does not know who its father is, either because the mother refused to tell him, or because the mother had relations with multiple men at the same time and can't actually ascertain who the father is. That is, the Stucki is a child, best not to give your kid the nickname Stucki. I mean, Stucki is fine, but Stucki is not great. Stucki is a kid who has no halakhic father, because we only have somewhere out there a biological father, but he has no halakhic father, and he may not be allowed to marry anybody, because we don't know who is going to be its relations and siblings. So that case at the beginning is there's definitely a mother, but we don't know who the father is. Let's give a second case. Good. So maybe that we will be able to, the Stucki case will be less. The question is, can we ascertain paternity through a DNA test? That's halakhically. Because halakha has to be able to work not just in the 21st century, but also in 3rd century Yemen. And if you need a DNA, that's another shear which is a not for now. Case number two. Let's look at this case. In the middle of page 6. Woman A donates the enucleated egg and carries the child. And man A donates the nucleus. Oh, so now we have something coming from the man. He didn't give a sperm, he gave one of his nuclei from himself. So, is he now the father? So, normally the father inputs 50% of the genetic material through a sperm. This guy inputted 99% of the genetic material. The 1%, don't forget, was from the mitochondria of the egg. So, if a 50% is enough to make you the dad, would 99% not be even more so enough? Or maybe no, maybe you need a sperm. Maybe just giving a cell is not enough to make you a father. We don't have a clear answer to that question either. Case number three. A Jewish woman donates the egg, donor egg, and carries the fetus, and a non-Jewish woman gives the nucleus. The clone now has 99% of its genetic material from a non-Jewish woman, and 1% from a Jewish woman, and it was carried by a Jewish woman. Is the kid Jewish or is the kid not Jewish? Now, the birth mother was Jewish, but the genetic material is from almost entirely from a non-Jewish woman. What determines the birth mother? And what determines the halakhic mother? And we talked about this some months ago when we did our share on surrogacy, which I'm not going to go through all now, but in a surrogacy scenario, which is not cloning, it's a little bit different, but where you have a different birth mother from the mother who is the genetic mother. So the poskim have gone back and forth on who would be the halakhic mother. And surrogacy happens all the time now. It's a very common procedure. At the beginning, back in the 90s when surrogacy first came in, most of the poskim were inclined to say that the birth mother is the halakhic mother. And if you remember that shir, there were sources from Dina and Rachel and Yaakov. I don't know if you were here at that shir. All sorts of interesting sources. Nowadays, the poskim are more likely to be leaning towards, or some poskim anyway, the genetic mother being the halakhic mother, in which case maybe this baby is not Jewish. Or maybe this baby has two mothers. Halakhically, maybe you can have multiple mothers. Maybe it has the birth mother, who is Jewish, and the genetic mother, who is not Jewish. So if a baby has two mothers, one who is Jewish and one who is not Jewish, is the baby Jewish? Are you Jewish because you have a Jewish mother? Or are you Jewish because you don't have a non-Jewish mother? Now, in almost every situation, those two things are identical, but not here. Because you can say, yes, it does have a Jewish mother, but it does not have a non-Jewish mother. So what's going to be now as well? What happens if we get into technology where we can splice multiple genes from multiple eggs together to create something? Are they all going to be halakhically the parents? That's another situation. Have a look, please, in case number four. Here, we have three different women doing three different things. Woman A gives the egg, woman B gives the nucleus, woman C carries the baby. Does the baby have three mothers? How does that work? And there are other cases of that nature. What if a woman gives the egg and the brother gives the nucleus? Is that some kind of incest? Is that some kind of incest? Meaning incest is between a sister and a brother with a physical relationship. But if the brother gives 99% of the genetic material carried inside the sister's egg, are we going to extend some kind of definition of mamzerut to the child or incest? What if the sister gives the nucleus? Meaning we understand there's such a thing as incest between brothers and sisters, but is there now a new concept of incest between sisters and sisters? Because there's two sisters tend to now produce a baby. One sister gives the nucleus and the other sister gives the egg. Are we going to have to try and work out whether there's a some issue there as well? Again, this is not science fiction. This is stuff which could be happening in many ways at some point soon. Could the sibling be, could the clone be considered a sibling, like an identical twin? Or could the clone even be you? There are all sorts of people who want to clone themselves because they think that they'll live forever. You know? So how does that work? If you clone yourself, is the clone then married to the person that you're married to by virtue of the fact that it's an extension of you? Does it own all your money, etc., etc.? Let's just end with a couple of things. What about Mumsy Roots? Now, a Mamza, it's very hard to produce a Mamza, which is very fortunate because it's a terrible thing, God forbid, for someone to be a Mamza. But a Mamza can only be created through either an adulterous relationship or an incestuous relationship. Obviously, I'm sure everyone knows, a child which is born out of wedlock is not in any way halakhically considered to be a Mamza and has no stigma in that sense. And therefore, we talked a little bit about this last week. What is necessary to create Mamzi Root? When Rav Moshe Feinstein gave the psak that I mentioned before, permitting artificial insemination by donor, he said in order to create Mamzi Root, there has to be a physical relationship between two people. Simply to take the sperm of a man who is not a husband and fertilize her egg in a lab, or maybe even inject that into her, which will be obviously a step further towards a problematic scenario, that's not called incest. Now, there were other people, or adultery in this case, there were other people who were very against that. The Satmarov said, it absolutely is. That is called, the produces mamzerus, that is called a relationship outside marriage. The Chelkis Yaakov, Rav Reich, who I mentioned last week, who opposed Rav Moshe, he said, it may not be technically adultery, but I brought you a little quote in the middle of the page. He said, but it's a chilul Hashem. From the point of view of our religion, these ugly and disgusting things should not be done, for they are similar to the deeds of the lands of Canaan and its abominations. Rav Moshe turned around and said, like, where did you get that from? It's not halakhically prohibited. This is a Jewish couple that want to have a baby. This is not the ideal way of producing a Jewish family, but this is not an ideal scenario. And Rav Moshe therefore said to him, as I said last week, I go by the Torah and only the Torah. I'm not interested in what the Catholics think. He said, even the Catholics don't do this. He said, I'm not interested. Well, the Catholics do. I'm interested in the Makairos. And if it's not prohibited, then it's presumably permitted, even though far from ideal. Could cloning even be a cure for Mamzerus? How do you cure Mamzerus? Because it's very difficult, because it passes down the male side and it passes down the female side. Look in number 13, Shulchan Aruch. Mamza habal akum. If the man who's a mamza has a relationship with a non-Jewish woman, hablad akum. Obviously the child is non-Jewish. But he's not allowed to get married to a non-Jewish woman because a mamza is not allowed to marry out either. But the child is not Jewish. But in Nidgayer, if the child converts, harihu kiyisrael, then it's now Jewish and it's not a mamza. It's a ger, it's a convert. So there, that cures the mamza irut, but you're not allowed to do it because a Jewish man who happens to be a mamza is not allowed to marry out just to cure the mamzerut with his children, because it's a Torah prohibition to marry out. But in Bala Shifcha, but if he can find a Shifcha Kananit, a Shifcha Kananit is a non-Jewish woman who is a Shifcha, she's a slave, an Eved, Shifcha is a female version of an Eved, but she's half converted to Judaism. The Eved Ivri, or the Shifcha Kananit, was not just a regular slave back in the day, but he was someone who was on the road to conversion. They kept certain mitzvahs, and once they were free, went to the mikvah, they were a full-fledged Jew. So if this mamza can find a Shifcha Kananit, and then do what? In Baal HaShifcha, for Havlad Eved, then the child will be an Eved as well. Nishtachrer, but then when you can free the child, Harizet ben Chorin, then it's got rid of the mamzeres. Lefikach, says the Shulchan Aruch, mamze nosele hatchil HaShifcha, that if you're a mamze, if you can find a Shifcha, Shekibla alea mitzvot v'tavla, that is accepted upon herself to keep Torah, and she goes to the mikveh to become a full Jew eventually. Ulashem avoda, Ulashem avdus, okay? Ulahati banav, shishishtachru, you can free the children, v'yu mutarim v'yisraelis, and then the mamzerus is all gone. Now, it's not that easy to find a ship for Canaanites these days. We, thank God, don't have many societies in which slavery is de rigueur. But we can perhaps do this with cloning. Meaning, can someone who is a mamza be able to create a clone of themselves, which is not then produced by some kind of relationship, but produced by cloning, and thereby remove the mamzerus from the line? That may even be an opportunity rather than a problem. So what is our conclusion in conclusion? Our conclusion is that it's very complicated, and is as follows. Pretty much, there's almost nobody that has a real halachic clear, precise halakhic problem with cloning. However, many of the poskim have meta-halakhic and hashkafic issues, and they fall into different categories. Some of the major poskim have not really given a clear lead on this issue yet, because it's not really the maisa. Because most cloning, as we said so far, is mostly stem cell research, which is clearly fine and therapeutic, etc. And I've listed some writers who are negative. Rav Jacobovich was negative, Rabbi Abraham Abraham was negative, Rav Lau is negative, and some writers who are positive, Rav Steinberg is positive, Rav Tendler is positive, etc. And we'll see. At the moment, Baruch Hashem, we're able to use cloning research to cure people, to cure cancers, to find cures for diseases we don't yet have cures for, and that is for sure 100% fine. But if one day people start popping out of the woodwork who are cloned people, then just have this source sheet to hand. And when they ask you, do I count for a million, you'll know what to say. Next week, the more down-to-earth, but perhaps more spirit-based issue of whiskey and the cashless thereof. Have a good week.